Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to All About Living. It must mean that you're either not at the game or that Wisconsin is so far ahead in the score that you decided you know the outcome already, and so let's tune in today to All About Living. We're so happy to have you with us. This segment of our program is brought to you by the Medicine Shop Monona, caring beyond prescriptions, and independent living, your connection to an independent life. Well, a couple of just little announcements before we go into the conversation with our guest today, and I'm so excited to have him in the studio, and I know once you find out who it is and hear his story, you'll enjoy it as well. But next Saturday, October 2nd, is a big day in Dane County. It's the Dane County Alzheimer's Walk at Warner Park, and I'm going to be there walking in the walk, and I just want to invite anybody who is listening to participate in one way or another, if at all possible. Either come to the walk and take the walk with the rest of us. It's there's only a 2-mile, very simple walk, or you can even do a 5K run. Do it at your own pace and join the many, many people and their families who are supporting the effort to eradicate Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia, and it's growing in epidemic proportions. So far, there is no cure. And there are researchers that are delving into the mysteries of this disease. And right here at the University of Wisconsin, we're proud to have an Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. But there are those currently living with dementia and so many of the families that care for them who are really desperately seeking support. They need programs and services today that can help people better understand the complexities of the disease and cope with the day-to-day challenges that really compromise quality of life for everyone, not only the person who has been diagnosed with Alzheimer's or another form of dementia, but it compromises the quality in life and the health of the caregivers as well. It's a devastating experience, and I've had that happen in my own family. And so I turned to the Alzheimer's Alliance myself previously when I encountered this in my own family, and it was such a source of support and peace and security and helped give me some direction on how to go forward and with someone who was suffering from this disease. So if you choose to support the Alzheimer's Walk in Dane County, you can go to alzwisc.org and click on information about the Dane County Alzheimer's Walk, and you'll find out even more information about it. You can show up at Warner Park anytime after 8 o'clock in the morning. The walk starts about 9:30 next Saturday. Or you can go to alzwisc.org and just find out about the many programs and services that the Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance of Wisconsin offers. The Alliance covers services in 9 states throughout southwestern Wisconsin and is so pleased to do that because people who are in the outlying areas and rural areas are being served in ways that they otherwise could not be. And it also advocates for the entire state of Wisconsin. All monies raised stay in Wisconsin, and they serve the citizens of Wisconsin who are in need of the programs and services. So next Saturday, October 2nd, Warner Park, Saturday morning, it's the Dane County Alzheimer's Walk, and we invite you to be there in person, contribute financially, or both. Thank you so much, and I hope to see you next Saturday. And I'm getting an applause here from our guests. Let me now go on and introduce you to him and keep the speculation now, eliminate that part of it, because a person that is certainly a familiar person to the Midwest Family Broadcasting family is in the studio with me. He spent 32 years here working for the company, and you were part of the management team, Bill.
Yeah, I was the general manager for about 13 years.
Yes, and then just part of the organization, and your voice has been heard many times, and it still is.
Best known for the old days when we had before Magic became Magic 98, it was 98 FM, Movin' Easy, and people remember me for saying the time. It's 1210, that sort of thing.
You know, and that's really a valuable service for a radio station to offer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. They should think they should do more of that. But anyway, Bill Vansell is here. Bill has a guest that has returned to the program today. He was here a few years ago, and that was when you were talking about your book, Don't Fear the Big Dogs. And you had been through the experience of being diagnosed with prostate cancer, and you researched the appropriate treatment plan for you, which you determined to be Loma Linda, California, at the University
Loma Linda. When I was diagnosed with prostate cancer in January of 2004, the urologist locally here was a tremendous doctor, and I admire him very much, and I still go to him, suggested surgery. But I suggested that I didn't want to do surgery, so I did my homework, and I found out about something called proton radiation treatment. And at that time, it was only performed at three places in the country, at Loma Linda, California, who started it, started doing this about 20 years ago, and a couple other places at Harvard University, at Mass General, and also at Bloomington, Indiana, at Indiana University. And I decided to go to Loma Linda. I was there for about 2 months, had the proton radiation treatment, which involves no surgery. It's totally non-invasive. You're not even admitted to the hospital. And my daughter, Tori Lou, Victoria Louise, she hates it when I say her whole name. Tori Lou came out and joined me for several weeks, and we had such a tremendous time. An old guy and a daughter 50 years younger than him, a teenager, out in California in a foreign country, doing things like surfing and going skateboarding and visiting other cities around the state, San Francisco and San Diego. And it was such an incredible experience, such a bonding thing for us that I decided to write a book about it. And the book is Don't Fear the Big Dogs, written primarily about the experience I had with my daughter, but also because I mentioned and talked about, to some extent, proton radiation treatment in the book. It became fairly important as an early book, that one of the first books to talk about this form of treatment. And I ended up doing a lot of book tours around the country, Barnes & Noble events in about 25 mm-hmm. different cities, and lots of radio and TV interviews.
And it's so important for people diagnosed with any condition to find support systems and the credibility of somebody who has been through the experience to share their stories and to give them a boost. And
I've talked with easily more than 100 men who have are considering what type of treatment they want to do. They find my name on a list on the internet of someone who's had the treatment. They call me up and I talk with them mm-hmm. about it. But I never tell them this is the only way to go.
Right.
Because I know people who have done surgery for prostate cancer, and it's been very successful. They are doing just fine. And so I tell people to do your homework, as I did, find out which form of treatment you would be most comfortable with and where to go for that treatment that you would be most comfortable with. And then once you've made that decision, have total confidence in that choice and go into it with a positive attitude and believe in the people that are going to be performing the treatment and keep that attitude that this is going to work. I know this is the best place for me to be and have the best, I'm getting the best treatment for the problem that I have. And if you do that and you maintain that positive attitude, you're going to be okay. If your choice is surgery, have that same attitude toward that. But make the choice you're comfortable with so you can have confidence in your choice and then keep a positive attitude.
There are many treatment options for prostate cancer and other cancers and other conditions, and not every place, every hospital in the country services all of the treatment options. So oftentimes for any condition, you research what is being done where and where do you go for the most expertise
That's
in the
right.
treatment of choice.
If people are interested in learning more about proton treatment, and if they're interested in finding out more about my book, Don't Fear the Big Dogs, I would invite them to come to the website, Don't Fear the Big Dogs. Don't put the apostrophe in don't. Go to don'tfearthebigdogs.com. There are links on there to the places that do proton treatment, a lot of information about it, and a lot of photos from our trip on which the book was based. So if they go there, they can link to the Loma Linda website, to other websites of other places doing proton.
Yes, and there are more places doing the proton radiation.
There's one about to open near here down in northern Illinois. A year ago, this summer, I went to the groundbreaking for a proton treatment center that's in near Batavia, where the Fermi Labs are, and it's going to be operated by Northern Illinois University.
Mm-hmm.
And so that'll be open soon. There's some other ones that have opened, MD Anderson in Houston, Jacksonville, Florida, at University of Florida, Shands, and there's some other locations around the country. But people can pick up on all of this by going to either my book website, as I mentioned, or it's another great website is called Proton Bob, B-O-B. That stands for Brotherhood of the Balloon, which is mm-hmm. a fraternity of guys who've had proton treatment. There's lots of testimonials on there, a lot of information about proton radiation treatment. It's protonbob.com. It's operated, the website's operated by a guy named Bob Marchini, but the Bob doesn't stand for Bob. Bob is in Robert. But he also has a book that I highly recommend if someone has been diagnosed with prostate cancer. I tell people when I go to support group meetings and things, I say, now Bob's got this terrific book. It's called You Can Beat Prostate Cancer and You Don't Need Surgery to Do It. And if you go to Proton Bob, there's a link to buy the book there if you wanted to do that. It's also available on Amazon. But I often tell people, I say, if you only can buy one book on this topic, buy Bob's book. If you can buy two, then buy one of his and one of mine.
One of yours.
If you can buy three, then buy one of his and two of mine.
Well, what's so valuable about it is knowledge is power, and it gives you a sense of being in charge of what's happening to you, in charge of your disease, in charge of your life. And just reading about or listening to somebody who's gone through the process of deciding what is best for him or her is helpful in people deciding how they're going to go about their own personal journey.
Right. When I decided to go to California, I felt that was the best form of treatment for me. It's 2,000 miles away. I'm very glad that I did. When I found out that I had advanced liver disease last year, early this year, I did some homework and found out that the best place for me to go was 35 minutes from my house at UW Hospital,
right here
in Madison.
Wisconsin, yes.
And I looked at other places, Chicago and Cleveland Clinic and other centers.
So you did the
centers.
Same research.
Yeah, I looked at Mayo, looked at all the different places, and I thought, UW Hospital, Wisconsin is so far up the list, and it's only a half hour from my house, I'd be nuts to go anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, they did a fabulous job of giving me a brand new liver, and it's working great, and I feel terrific.
Well, we're going to get into that part of your life story. Before we do that, I do want to ask you, there's some significance to the title, Don't Fear the Big Dogs. Tell us the background about that.
Yeah, when I was a kid, I was about 9 years old. We traveled a lot, my parents and I. We were out in New England somewhere, and we stopped someplace, and there was this huge Great Dane I walked right up to him, and I put my arm around his shoulders. He was taller than me, and my mom snapped a photo of that, and later I came across that picture, and I framed it. And it's when I was working here at the Midwest Family. We have all the, you know, board of directors meetings and all this kind of stuff. And so I put that up on the wall of my office, and I put a little caption under it that said, "Don't fear the big dogs." And then later around the turn of the century, around 2000, and when I left the Midwest Family to start my own graphic design business, I hung it in my office. And it was on the wall when I made the phone call to Loma Linda that finalized that I was going to go there for treatment. And as I hung up the phone from making that decision to go to Loma Linda for proton treatment, I looked up at the wall and saw that picture. And I thought, yeah, prostate cancer is a big dog. Mm-hmm. I don't fear the big dogs. And that ended up being the title of the book.
Well, it has served you law really well. You have been on quite a journey from the time when you were diagnosed with the prostate cancer and how you dealt with that. You haven't feared the big dogs all the way along. And your newest adventure, which you have just completed, and we're so pleased that you're here today, and I'm sure you are too, because it was nip and tuck there for a while. And
I was pretty sick.
You were a very sick man, and we want to hear more about that. We're going to stop for a break right now and come back and continue our discussion with Bill Vansell, former part of the management team, the executive team here at Midwest Family Broadcasting. He has a background other than the fact that he survived prostate cancer and just recently a liver transplant. He studied art, music, and speech at Illinois Wesleyan University and Augustana College. And in addition to being a broadcasting executive, he now has moved into owning his own graphic design firm. And he has become an author, written the book Don't Fear the Big Dogs, and now a new book, Roy and Kitty, which we'll also get into. And if you stay tuned towards the end of the program, you're going to get a creative little excerpt of the book. You're listening to All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTDY. If you want to call and have a conversation with Bill during this program, 321-1670 or *123 on your U.S. cellular drive. And we'll be right back after these messages. And we're back with our program. This segment is brought to you by Gunderson Funeral and Cremation Care, the Life Celebration Center, and Turville Bay MRI and Radiation Oncology Center in Madison, where expertise with compassion is powerful medicine. Our guest today, a very special person to the program, to the company, to Midwest Family Broadcasting, Bill Vansell. And Bill Vansell is a former manager from Midwest Family Broadcasting. He spent 32 years here as a part of the staff, and then he went on to form his own graphic design firm. But during those years, he also encountered a diagnosis of prostate cancer, which he researched and dealt with, and through the knowledge he received, he determined what the proper course of treatment was for him. And he has just related his story of ending up at Loma Linda, California, at the University of California, to be treated with the proton radiation treatment for prostate cancer. And that's just one of the treatment options available to people, but you found it served you very, very well. And it's amazing how challenges in life can put you on a journey or an adventure or turn your life into a new arena that you otherwise wouldn't have followed.
That's right. And my experience at Loma Linda helped me a great deal in my battle with my liver disease.
Now tell us, this was your prostate cancer was about 6 years ago?
That's right.
And you have remained cancer-free
all the six years.
So that you put on the back burner.
That's right.
Yeah, been there, done that.
Way back.
Been there, done that.
For folks who know what a PSA test is, my PSA before treatment was 7.15, which is fairly high. And after treatment, and ever since, for 6 years, my PSA has been less than 0.05. So I'm done with prostate cancer. And I'm pretty much done with liver transplant, although I have to give this liver graciously donated by someone I don't know who it was. But I have to give it a good home and take good care of it,
because
it's taking good care of me.
Well, and this has been very recent, and I know everybody around the building here has been most concerned about you. And when you walked in today, when the people were here and saw you, they were just delighted
to
see you.
They were chanting.
Yeah, yes.
He lives. He lives.
Well, and you look terrific. Tell us what happened. This has been a recent occurrence
in
your life.
It was late summer last year. I started to have some pain, and it turned out it was a hernia problem that I had to have surgery for. But my liver function readings had always been a little bit elevated over recent years, and we've been kind of watching that carefully. But because of needing surgery for the hernia, we thought it might irritate or exasperate the liver problem. But it got to the point where we just had to go do the surgery, so we did, and it did exasperate the liver. Liver didn't like that, and the liver function readings went through the off the charts. There's a thing called a MELD test, which stands for Model End-Term Liver Disease, and it's kind of a scary definition of that, but that's what it is. And basically, if you're over 15, you're a pretty good candidate for a liver transplant. In other words, if you're over 15, you'd live longer if you have a transplant. If you're under 15, you probably live longer if you don't have a transplant. That's how that works. Mine was 17, so a little over the edge. After the hernia surgery, my MELD score, the highest the computer will recognize is 40. I was 43.
Oh, my.
So I got a chance to move way ahead in the waiting list for a liver, because I had to have one. I had to have one soon. And they found one, did the surgery. The doctors, who were tremendous, Dr. Fernandez, Dr. Kim, they said, this liver is not too good. Bill needs a better liver than this. So they put me back on the list, and about 5 days later, they had another liver.
So they did transplant the first liver, though.
Yeah, and I lived on that, on the edge, for five days.
Before you had that transplant, how close to death were you at that point?
Well, how far are you from me right now?
Not very
I don't
far.
Know how close, but it was too close.
But when they get to, when it gets to that point of being moved ahead on the list, and you're talking days, you know, a couple of weeks.
Yeah, all the people, my friends and family, my girlfriend Andrea, they were all just chewing their nails and saying, you know, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. And I was out of it, so I didn't know. But when I woke up, I heard this rumor that I'd had two surgeries. I said, wait a second, I only signed up for one. Is this true? And I kept asking people, saying, I think so. And then finally, when I heard it right from Dr. Fernandez himself, he said, yeah, we did two. The first liver wasn't any good. I got you another one. I said, okay, thanks. And it turns out that ever since then, the liver's been doing great. The difficulty is not so much recovering from having a new liver, although you have to take a lot of medications and you have to do a lot of things. But the impact that that sort of major surgery has on you, I lost about 70 pounds. I lost my balance. I lost my appetite. I had a feeding tube in me for two months. I was in the hospital 3.5 months. The recovery and the rehabilitation and getting your balance back and getting your muscle tone back and all that kind of stuff takes time. But now I'm getting there. I'm not back 100%, but I'm probably 85 or 90% back, and I'm healthier than I was, way healthier than I was before the surgery. And I'm at a more healthy weight, thinking clearly, and I'm just, you know, doing fine. And Dr. Fernandez, last time I saw him for a routine checkup, he said, you know, we got you over the recovery from the surgery. That's done. Now we need to work on getting you through the next 20 or 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
That was very nice to hear that.
Yes, yes. And that is not unusual with organ transplants anymore. Tell me, you went through the experience of the prostate cancer, and through your research, you independently went to the University of California, Loma Linda, had the proton radiation.
Excuse me, it's not University of California. It's Loma Linda University.
Oh, I'm sorry.
At Loma Linda, California.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I thought
that was part of the University of California system, but it isn't. Okay.
No, it's operated actually by the Adventist Church.
Oh.
And it's a huge facility. It's a major trauma center for Southern California, and people haven't heard about it because the Adventists are not very good at promoting themselves, but it's a tremendous place.
You know what? And this is a sidebar to our conversation. We'll get back on to our conversation regarding your liver transplant. But Loma Linda, California is one of the four blue zones that were identified by Dan Buettner in his book, The Blue Zone.
Yeah, the folks in Loma Linda.
They live longer than more people live to be over 100 than in any other
anywhere
place.
In the country.
Yes.
And you know why? They don't drink. They don't smoke. They don't drink caffeine. They somehow figure out a way to have fun, and they live a long time. And they're great people.
They keep moving. They go on. They have balance in life. They take family time. They go on long walks. They hike. They don't just sit around and eat. And they're very cautious about eating. Eating locally, eating what they grow. And
I have great admiration for their lifestyle and what they do and how they treat each other. Another side note: there's an ordained minister there who runs the support group meetings at Loma Linda. His name is Lynn Martell. I'm going to see Lynn tomorrow. They're having an event at a Adventist hospital down in LaGrange, Illinois. In fact, when we're done with this show, I'm driving down to Chicago and going to this brunch tomorrow. And the president of Loma Linda University will be there, and Lynn Martell, and they've invited folks from the Midwest area around Chicago area who are former proton patients to come and join them and hear what's going on at Loma Linda. But Lynn Martell, out of the 10,000 or more men have had proton treatment, and you feel like they're giving all to you, and they don't preach. They don't try to convert you to any religion. They just care. And Lynn Martell called me at least 10 times while I was in the hospital and prayed for me, with me, over the phone. And And I also had such support from other friends locally and all over the country, emails and phone calls from coast to coast, some out of the country. It was tremendous. And in fact, I'm just starting on another book, and part of it's going to be the advantage and the benefit and the strength in having support from your friends.
Yes.
And how important it is to maintain friendships.
That has been well established
from 40 years ago.
In healing, you heal better when you feel that you're cared for, you're cared about, and it's important to somebody, to a community of people, that you are there. And in fact, that was one of the aspects of the Blue Zones, Dan Buettner's book. I happened to interview him, and we talked about the four areas of the world, and it's very simple, the thread that runs through all these areas. And it's not about a magic pill or magic medicine, although where you have to be grateful for medical technology because it can save lives like yours when you need it. But our health and well-being is really tied so closely to how we live our daily lives
and your attitude,
choices we make sense of having a purpose for your life.
Right, and maintaining that positive attitude and knowing that so many people out there care about you, it makes you think, well, if all these people are so concerned, it's probably a good thing if I stay around. And you realize how important it is to keep that attitude. And that's what I said earlier, that that attitude that I formed when I went to Loma Linda, I maintained that when I was going through the liver transplant. People ask me, they say, weren't you scared? And I thought about it, and I thought, you know what? Because I did my homework and I figured out UW Hospital in Madison was the best place to go. I had some of the best surgeons in the country, and I had the right attitude, and I passed all the general tests you need to test to be eligible for a transplant. I had no question that it was going to work. And then they say, "Weren't you afraid?" And I said, "You know, I have to honestly admit, I don't remember ever experiencing fear during this thing. I knew it was going to be okay."
Was this because of the lessons you had learned from your experience in California and your experience dealing with prostate cancer?
I think that, compounded by the fact that people were coming from everywhere, showing support and telling me, that they were thinking about me and praying for me. Yeah. And I have, an ordained minister in a Seventh-day Adventist minister in Loma Linda, a good friend who's a doctor in who is Jewish in Florida, a friend who lives in the Midwest who's a Bible Belt Baptist, and people in Chicago who are Catholics, all these people praying for me. And I'm thinking, wow, they can't all be wrong. They may all be right, but, hallelujah. One of them must have got through. And here I am, and I'm here because I knew I had that support and that backing of all these people. And they cared so much about me that I thought, I'm going to stay alive, if not for me, for them. And here I am.
Well, the University of Wisconsin Organ Transplant Program is phenomenal. We've done several programs with them here on All About Living. And our guest today is Bill Vancell, if you've just tuned in. And Bill Vancell is just recently the recipient of a brand new liver at the University of Wisconsin through their organ transplant program. And if you are interested in being an organ donor, you probably heard about the YesIWillWisconsin.com promotion to register as an organ donor right here in our state of Wisconsin. You may have a yellow dot on your license, on your driver's license, but that no longer is the official registration. It will give guidance to your family and to the medical team working with you that you do want to be a donor, but actually now there's an online registry available and you can go on that registry and register yourself to be an organ donor, and it is legally binding, and it eliminates somebody else having to make the decision. So if you go to YesIWillWisconsin.com, you will find out the details how to simply register to be an organ donor here in the state of Wisconsin. I did it myself, and it took at the most a minute. It's a very simple process. And I know, Bill, you have to be so grateful that somebody did that for you.
I would encourage everyone to do that, to register, because it saved my life, and I think everyone should consider doing that. I don't know if I would qualify. I don't know if anybody want all my old parts, but I think healthy people definitely should do that. I have a 19-year-old daughter, and she just texted me.
Yes?
I had to get this text, a cell phone with a full keyboard so I can communicate with it. That's the only way you can communicate with teenagers.
Isn't that the truth?
But she just texted me, and she said, Dad, you're doing great. I love you, and I'm glad you are sharing your knowledge with everyone. That's Tori Lou, the one that went on the trip with me.
Yes.
So bless her heart.
Well, and your relationship with Tori Lou was certainly strengthened through the experiences that you've had with your with the prostate cancer and now the liver transplant.
Yeah. Well, and as long as we're tossing out kudos, I have to mention Andrea Bike, Andy Bike, my girlfriend, who used to also work
yes.
here at the radio station. And I've known her since about 1974, and she was with me through this whole procedure. Actually, came out to California twice during the proton treatment, during my stay in the hospital, took care of my house and my dog and cat, Roy and Kitty,
mm-hmm.
And took care of my car and my paid bills for me and all that kind of thing, and came up to the hospital every single day that I was there. And she's still with me, making sure, you know, I get through this, and, you know, who knows.
Well, I have to give kudos to her also, because she was in communication with us here,
yeah.
and so we were kept abreast of your progress.
Well, and everybody I've talked to has said what a tremendous job she did, and
I truly appreciate it. Yeah, and been part of the reason you're here today is just because of the communication with Andy through
if Andy's listening, I send out my thanks again, and if she can figure out how to work an AM radio, she might be listening. I don't know.
Well, either that or she, Andy, and anybody else listening and want to pass this program along to anyone else, you can go to carolcobyradio.com, www.carolcobyradio.com. And this program will be posted by late afternoon Monday, and you can access it at your convenience. We're going to continue our conversation with Bill Vansell, but first, these messages from our sponsors. You're listening now to All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTDY. I'm Carol Coby, and stay tuned because we'll be right back. And this segment is brought to you by Home Health United. You've got a friend right here online at homehealthunited.org. And I know the messages encouraged you to contact Home Health United either online or give them a call, because it's flu shot season. And you do want to get that flu shot. And it's very, very easy to get it through Home Health United. I did it last year, and it's on my list of things to do for this year to go over there and to get the flu shot. They have many, many clinics available for this, and you'll find out more information if you go to homehealthunited.org. Our guest today, Bill Vansell, and we're hearing his dramatic and stirring story of the journey he's been on for, well, a little less than a decade now, starting with prostate cancer about 6 years ago, and now the current location of where you are in your life's journey is that you are a recent liver transplant patient, and you just received a new liver, actually the second one. You got two within 1 week,
right?
Which was right over this past, was it December that you actually received the livers?
Yeah, the surgery was the surgery for the second liver was on February 4th, I believe, and I was in the hospital a total of from the end of last part of December through the middle of April. I was in the hospital 3.5 months.
If I can just borrow into your brain a little bit and have you recall some of your personal thoughts during this time. We've had several of the doctors and the specialists and the people that are so closely associated with the organ transplant program at the University of Wisconsin. We've been doing a lot promoting people to go to yesiwillwisconsin.com to register online as organ donors in the state of Wisconsin. If you have the orange dot on your driver's license, that's okay. That's great. It still gives some guidance, but you want to go online to really be an official and legally binding donor to become a donor for organ transplants. But when did you first realize when you were in the hospital that you were going to have a liver transplant, and what was your reaction?
Well, I found out when the surgeon walked into my room at the hospital and said, "You need a new liver. You don't have any choice."
And you didn't know that before?
Well,
you'd had the hernia surgery.
I was kind of in a state of suspended disbelief. I sort of knew that I was going to have to go that direction, but, you know, I, like most folks, I always kind of thought of a liver transplant is something that the other guy does.
Exactly.
And it's kind of a death sentence, but it isn't. It's just the contrary. It opens up years and years and years of new life. And once I realized that, it was like, okay, let's go for it. And then it was like,
so that was your immediate reaction?
Every time I heard that helicopter outside the hotel window, I thought, they're bringing my liver. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And for several days, it was no. But then they came in and said, we've got a liver for you. I said, let's go for it.
So it was a matter of a few days.
It was, close to a week, I think, when they found the first liver.
Right.
Turns out that liver wasn't of serving quality. So,
but they move very quickly once they
put me back on the list, and I was limping along, literally, lying along on this first liver while they looked for another one. And I skyrocketed to the top, as we used to say in radio, the tippy top of the pop chip crop. And so I was number one on the list in a 5-state area. And they found me another liver. And didn't know about this. I when I woke up, I didn't believe that I had two operations because I was down it for the whole time.
We've never really talked about what the actual timing and what physically happens after they walk in and say, we found a liver. What happens? Is the room swarmed with medical people, and do they prepare you immediately for surgery?
As soon as they have the liver, you're prepared mentally as best you can in advance. But as soon as they have that liver, they come in and they say, we're going to go in an hour or a half hour or whatever.
Okay.
And they come in and they wheel you into the operating room and they start you on some anesthesia. And then you wake up and say, what do you mean I had two operations? Oh. What do you mean it's next week?
And then after you woke up and finally were aware that you were alive, and you had two operations instead of one, did you fade in and out for a few days? Or are the sensations immediately after?
I had goofy dreams. I had, from the anesthesia and all the medication and everything, I had some pretty crazy dreams. The experience itself of being in the hospital, you learn a lot about for one thing, you learn that nurses rule the world. You do what the nurses say, or they bring in the head nurse and she whaps you on the wrist with a ruler. You know that they're not going to leave you alone. They don't want you to get bed sores. They come in at every 2 hours through the middle of the night. It's like Las Vegas. There's no clocks. They come in and roll you over, and I think they have specially trained nurses who are also roller derby participants. They come in the middle of the night and roll you over, and they don't care if it hurts. And they just say, come on, take it easy. You got to do this.
They know what they're doing, and that has to be comforting.
And after a while, you just say, well, okay, I'm going to let you guys, you know what you're doing, and go on with it. And when you're in the hospital that long, and you it gets kind of tiresome after a while, especially having the feeding tube where I couldn't eat any real food and I lost my appetite. And, I've always didn't ever like hospital food, but I had people bringing food in from outside and I couldn't even eat that because I'd lost my appetite completely. And they kept saying, you got to eat. You're never going to get out of here if you don't eat. Well, I ate just enough to get out of there. And once I got home, then I started eating quite well. And I actually got a few more pounds on me than what I wanted. But it's quite an experience.
How long after you got the second successful liver transplant did you leave the hospital? How long were you in the hospital?
I came home on April 16th. The surgery was February.
Oh, my.
First week in February.
So that was really a home away from home for a couple months.
Yeah, but I did miss a Wisconsin winter.
No.
I could see the snow outside, but I didn't shovel any of it.
No. And did you start to feel better relatively soon where you could be up and walking a little bit?
I think so. Once I got home, then I went pretty quickly from wheelchair to walker to cane.
But you were doing some of that in the hospital before
released. It's way better once you get where you don't have to have a court order to get out of bed on your own. And my recovery really catapulted once I got home.
And what is your life like now? What do you have to do? What do you have to take? And how long? And what is permanent? And what is still?
I have to be careful, to not try to move too fast, lose my balance. I've got most of my balance back, and my muscle strength's coming back. I'm working out. I do swimming for an hour a day over at the UW Center over on Science Drive in their 94-degree pool. I love that. So I'm getting my strength back, but I have to be careful that I don't fall down the stairs or something dumb like that. I have to take a lot of meds. I take about 9 different medicines in the morning and another 8 or 9 in the evening. I've been doing insulin at least for now, although I'm hoping to get off of that. So there's a lot of medication, a lot of that stuff, and just being careful and, you know, doing the things that are right. I'll never have another alcoholic drink in my life because that's bad for livers, and I got to promise I would take good care of this new one. So it's, your lifestyle changes, but in a way it improves because you learn to appreciate life way more, especially when you've dodged a bullet twice.
And you have more reverence for the home in which that liver is.
Yeah.
And
part of my the book that I'm just starting on, and I hope to get it finished before too long, part of that I'm thinking of making a contact, which you can do, to the family of the donor. And if they're interested in finding out where their liver, their family member's liver ended up, then you can make contact with them.
What is that process?
Well, you write a letter that's sort of generic, and you don't say really who you are or any clues so they can really identify you. And then they say, yeah, I'd like to know more about this person. And then you make contact, and then you take it from there. And there's got to be some hesitation on the part of the donor's family because they want to see, you know, what if our, you know, Eddie's liver ended up in a jerk?
Mm-hmm.
And then from my standpoint, I'm like, do I want to really know where this liver came from? You know, maybe it's a famous, talented, wonderful person, you know, or maybe it's some guy in prison. I don't know. But I know whoever it was cared enough about me to make the ultimate sacrifice. So I think I want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do, I think that process and what comes of it could be an interesting part of the book.
I've heard some stories from organ recipients. And they have met the people, the families of the people who had donated the organ. And it's just powerful experiences. Mm-hmm. One person was in the wedding of one of the family members.
Yeah.
and representing the family member who had passed away. Just touching stories. But you talk about it's the ultimate, and it is the ultimate gift. And it's a gift that all of us can do if we're alive, is to go to yesiwillwisconsin.com and register to be an organ donor. But you have remained, and I think even been more inspired to be your creative self, and you've written a book, a very touching book.
I think you meant aspired, not expired.
Did I say expired?
Yeah, you said expired. That's okay, though. You'll get on to it. It's okay.
No, you're doing, no. Yeah, that's not the road you are on. My apologies.
No.
Aspire. Roy and Kitty. And Roy and Kitty, when did you publish this book? It's very recent.
Yeah, it actually was last year, I think. Not the winter I was in the hospital, but the preceding winter. Kitty became part of our family, and the book tells about that.
So you moved from Fear the Big Dogs.
I took a lot of pictures of my
Kitty.
Dog and cat, and the pictures were so incredible, how the things they do together. I decided to make a book, and I at first it was going to be a children's picture book. It has a lot of pictures in it. It has over 40 full-color pictures in it.
Pictures are wonderful.
And so I had all these pictures, and then I thought, well, maybe I should make a book out of this. And I thought, well, rather than me tell the story, why don't I let Roy and Kitty tell the story? So the first half of the book is in Roy's words. Roy tells the story. The second half of the book is Kitty telling the story. And they both come to the same conclusion at the end of the book. It has to do with friendship of someone who's not the same as you. And it turns out adults are liking the book just as much as kids, if not more.
I loved it.
And so
I'm going to send a copy to my aunt, and I'm going to give a copy to my granddaughter. It is just charming. We're going to stop for our final break, and when we come back, we're going to give the listening audience just a snapshot of the
book.
This
will be, if you have an 8-track or a cassette or a cylinder recorder, or how do they do it these days? Oh, on the computer.
On the computer, yes.
If you can record this part, you're going to want to hear it over and over, so stay tuned.
Okay, and do stay tuned, because we'll be right back with more of our conversation with Bill Vanskill after these messages. I'm Carol Kobe, and you're listening to All About Living here on 1670 WTDY. We're back for our final minutes of our wonderful conversation with Bill Vanskill, whose journey has included prostate cancer and a liver transplant. And he is here today, just going really, really strongly in continuing in your the increase in your health and wellness, and using your creativity to continue to write. You've written the book, Don't Fear the Big Dogs, And you're writing a book currently about your recent experience as a liver transplant recipient. But in the meantime, last year, you wrote a touching, very sensitive story about your own dog and cat, Roy and Kitty.
That's right. Well, they wrote it, actually.
They wrote it. You were telling the audience about it a little bit, that it's from their perspective. Roy speaks.
You know what? Why don't we give them a dramatization?
Well, I think that's a good idea. We are going to give you a little snapshot of the book, and playing the role of Roy is Bill Vansell.
Thank you.
Playing the role of Kitty is Carol Kobe.
Wow. My name is Roy. I don't have a middle name. Some dogs do. Usually they're fluffy dogs who stand up real straight. My father has a middle name. It's The. Frank the Tank. He's a pug who lives on a farm in South Dakota. He's as wide as he is tall. And my mother is a beagle named Coco. I look like both of them. I think Frank and Coco are still together, but I'm not sure. I left home when I was 8 weeks old. That's how it is when you're a dog.
My name is Kitty. I used to be called Kitty Kitty. I grew up at a house in town. Well, I didn't grow all the way up there. I was less than a year old when I was taken to a place where they raise horses, called a stable. At the stable, I would curl up on straw to sleep. There were a couple of other cats, but we never got to be really good friends.
One day, a guy and his daughter, on their way home from a vacation in Oregon, stopped by where I was a puppy in South Dakota and took me to Wisconsin. They wrote some numbers on a piece of paper and gave it to the people who run the farm. I'm called a puggle because I'm half pug and half beagle. I have my father's curly pug tail, and my face is like my mom's, only my nose is a bit shorter. Everybody says I was a really cute puppy. We live out in the country, and there's a road that runs past the horse stable, and that's where we go for walks. I'm always on a leash because beagles like to sniff everything to find out where they lead to.
From the stable, I had a great view, and I'm a good watcher. Every few days, I would see a tan-colored dog walking his owner along the road. The dog would stop and sniff every few feet, and his owner would obey by stopping and watching. I had never seen a dog like him before, and he looked friendly, at least from a distance. His owner called him Roy.
One day while we were on a walk, a kitty came out from the stable. She was cute and seemed to like me. She sniffed my nose and rubbed her chin on my neck. It was the first time I'd seen a cat up close.
Roy's owner reached down and scratched my behind the ears. I knew I was going to get along fine with both Roy and his owner.
That's a typo. It's supposed to be
me
behind the ears. Oh my God. She watched us walk away when we headed back down the road, but she didn't follow us. Looking back, I noticed she watched for a while and then slowly walked back toward the barn. I decided then that cats are pretty cool, and I was hoping I'd see her again. A couple of weeks later, we saw the kitty walking up our long driveway. She climbed the stairs to our deck and came over to me. I wagged my tail, and she started hitting me with her paw. It was her way of saying she wanted to play. But she wanted to come in the house, and I didn't think my owner would let her.
I was happy when they let me in the house. It was nice with lots of windows to look out and good places to sit. I got up on the leather sofa in the living room, and Roy didn't mind. He sat next to me, and we watched TV. I had a feeling I was meant to be there. That night, I didn't want to leave, so I slept under the deck. I think Roy and his owner were surprised to see me outside the door the next morning. I was happy when they let me in again.
We checked with the people at the stable, and they said we could keep her. So we took her to a pet doctor, checked her over, and we decided to call her Kitty. That's what everybody had been calling her anyway, or sometimes Kitty Kitty. It's a people thing that they do with cats. Nobody ever calls me Roy Roy.
My favorite place to be is with my best friend Roy. I have learned a lot from him, like how to let your owner know when you want a treat. He also taught me to be gentle and friendly to visitors, but to be careful about strangers you meet in the woods.
Some say Kitty and I are like brother and sister. I think we're more like best friends, or even boyfriend and girlfriend.
The most important thing we have both learned is that it doesn't matter if your best friend is different from you. After a while, you discover that you're not really that different at all.
Was it luck that we met? Maybe it was something else. My owner says there's no such thing as a coincidence. I do know that a true friend, one you can trust and rub noses with, is one of the best things anyone can have.
Ooh.
Yikes.
That is lovely. That is lovely.
That was fun.
Yes. Beautifully written.
Sorry about that one typo in there.
No problem. We are just reading this.
Cold. Yeah. Well, I'm not reading exactly cold because I helped him write it, but you did a great job. And you hadn't seen the script before. That's tremendous.
Well, you did your usually good job, too. As you can tell, Bill Vansell is a perfect person. He was born to be on radio. His voice has been used very, very much and still continues to be used. He used to work here at Midwest Family Broadcasting 32 years. He then went on to open his own graphics design firm, was diagnosed with prostate cancer, overcame that, and only to move into severe liver disease, is now the recipient recently of a liver transplant, and continues to be a remarkable individual making a real contribution. Bill, for so many reasons, we are just delighted and pleased that you are here with us today.
Well, I'm happy to be back on your show again, and I hope you have me back sometime. Who knows what'll come up next?
What's around the corner? We'll want to hear. And thank you for listening to All About Living. Thank you, Jason, very much for giving us all the support. Remember this program and all of the others that you can listen to here on All About Living. You can find at www.carolcobyradio.com. Now, I hope the Badgers continue to do well. I hope they won the game. And you go out and enjoy this great weekend.